Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 21st, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have Gladys Moore continuing her Bible study entitled Heirs According to Promise. Would Saul have become Paul without Ananias? Today's session number is MOG 2005. Let's listen in.
Today is our last Bible study for this week, my last Bible study, but there will be more, so those of you who are here next week, don't be dismayed. Someone else will be doing Bible study. It's always important to, it's been nice to start the day with the Word. So I promised a full hymn today. Yes. We're only going to do three verses because I needed to save a little room on the bottom for some notes that we will... We'll make with each other. This is O Zion Haste. I hope you all know this hymn. Yes? Okay. And those of you who don't, when we get to the end of each verse, we go into the refrain, and that's this. Publish glad tidings, tidings of peace, tidings of Jesus' redemption and release. So you see a little R here and R here. That means each time we go back to publish glad tidings. Let's begin then with singing O Zion Haste.
O Zion Haste, your mission high fulfilling, to tell to all the world that God is light, that God who made all nations is not willing one soul should perish, lost in chains of
us with the good news and have called us to publish it to every people, tongue, and nation. We thank you for making us your children. We thank you for this opportunity that we have as family to study your word together. And we pray once again that you fill us with your spirit and enlighten us, that we might go to all of those who are on the fringes of our church and society and help to share the good news and be shaped by the good news that they have to share with us of your love for all. Amen. We were going to study Ananias today, and I decided that since we had only studied one woman this week, we needed another woman. So I changed our text to look at the Canaanite woman, and I've called her Sister Outsider in memory of Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde was a black lesbian feminist poet who taught poetry at Hunter College in New York City, a very provocative thinker, in my mind, probably one of the most provocative thinkers of the 20th century. Thankfully, her voice is still with us because she wrote a number of books. One of them was called Sister Outsider, and it's a fine book of essays, and I'd certainly encourage you to get it and read it sometime, because not unlike a lot of what we read in the gospel, Audre Lorde really pushed the boundaries and helped us to think about who's in and who's out. So today we're going to be looking at Sister Outsider, Heir According to Promise, and we will be reading from Matthew. Our main text is Matthew 15, verses 21 through 28, but like we did earlier in the week with the story of Zacchaeus, we're going to be doing some comparing and contrasting between a story that occurs earlier in Matthew's gospel. So you can turn to Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, while I give us a little background on the main text. Okay? So what I'm going to be sharing with you is really what comes right before in the Matthew 15 text. In that Matthew 15 chapter, Jesus has just had an encounter with the Pharisees over what is clean and unclean. And some of you may remember that earlier in the week we talked about this whole purity system, you know, where some are in, some are out, and certainly this whole business of what it meant to be ritually unclean was a very important issue in Judaism of Jesus' day. And so Jesus was, at least from the Pharisees' perspective, Jesus seemed to be very cavalier about these boundaries of who was in and who was out. Jesus ate with tax collectors and sinners. He often permitted himself to be touched by those who would be considered ritually unclean, lepers, women, prostitutes. And then in this text, which happens in 15:1 through 20, the real issue is, Jesus and his disciples, unlike us at Holden, don't seem to wash their hands before they eat. And now being on the recovering side of the cold, I want to encourage all of us to wash our hands. You know, there probably was a lot more to this business of washing hands than just a simple thing of who's in and who's out. But that was part of the issue. Who belongs and who's disqualified from being part of God's family? So Jesus' debate with the Pharisees in this 15th chapter of Matthew really is about who is part of the community of God, and how is that going to be defined? Obviously, we still wrestle with that question today. Who's in and who's out? And the story of the Canaanite woman pushes the boundaries even more. So let's read Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, and then try to keep your finger in that text as we go to the next, or listen very carefully so that you can remember the story in Matthew 8, because we're going to be doing some comparing to the text in Matthew 15. So I'm reading in Matthew chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, and then we'll ask somebody to read Matthew 15. When Jesus entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him, appealing to him and saying, "Lord, my servant is lying at home paralyzed in terrible distress." And Jesus said to him, "I will come and cure him." The centurion answered, "Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only speak the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes. And to my slave, 'Do this,' and the slave does it." When Jesus heard him, he was amazed and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, in no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and will eat with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the heirs of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." And to the centurion, Jesus said, "Go. Let it be done for you according to your faith." And the servant was healed in that hour. We're not going to discuss this text. You've heard it. Now let's turn to Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28. And if someone would read that, please.
Leaving that place, Jesus withdrew to the region of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman from that vicinity came to him crying out, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on me. My daughter is suffering terribly from demon possession." Jesus did not answer a word. So his disciples came to him and urged him, "Send her away, for she keeps crying out after us." He answered, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." The woman came and knelt before him. "Lord, help me," she said. He replied, "It is not right to take the children's bread and toss it to their dogs." "Yes, Lord," she said, "but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Then Jesus answered, "Woman, you have great faith. Your request is granted." And her daughter was healed from that very hour.
Thank you. Two texts about Jesus' encounter with Gentiles. What is similar about these texts? First, we want to focus on what is similar about these texts.
Each one is asking for healing on behalf of someone else.
Okay.
Close to the
point. We'll see if you get all the ones that the previous group I erased them, but they're committed to her. Both have someone who's asking for healing on behalf of somebody else. Okay.
Both are healed without him ever seeing them.
All right, now, have to give me a minute here, John. Okay, it was, he's healing without being there, what did you say?
Well, he never sees these
people.
Okay,
right.
Mm-hmm.
He heals from a distance, right.
Right, okay, or an abstention.
All right, other similarities. Oh, come on, group.
Well, they're both Gentiles.
They're both Gentiles, okay.
Healing is instantaneous.
Very good.
Jesus is man is both for their faith.
Right, well, within the hour, you know. Depends on coastal differences and all of this. Exactly. All right, healing is instantaneous.
He marvels at their faith.
He marvels at both of their faith, right?
And healing is based on the faith, too.
Wow. healing based on, I can't even say that. Healing based on faith. We try saying that. Three times fast.
With a cold.
With a cold, is that? Okay, anything else?
The setting is in the north, away from Jerusalem.
Okay, the setting is away from Jerusalem. Now, I have to say that I am geographically challenged, but I'm going to take Nancy's word for it. I know that Tyre and Sidon is northwest, certainly, about 30 miles.
In Lebanon.
Okay, all right. So and we can be confident. The setting is away from Jerusalem. Okay.
Well, and the other one, he was in Capernaum, which is right. The Sea of Galilee.
Okay. All right. Other similarities. What do they both call him?
Lord.
Lord, right? Which is kind of a funny thing for Gentiles to be calling, you know, this Jew. So again, when we read scripture, it's really important to try and see different levels in terms of the interpretation. What's going on in terms of the community of Matthew's day, the message that, you know, the church of his day needs, and what's happening in terms of the Jesus story itself. And then we read that, of course, with our own contemporary perspective and interpretation. So what didn't I write? Lord. They both call him Lord. Oh, my. You know, remember when Dan Quayle was quoting the Negro College fund, and he said, a mind is a terrible thing to lose. Well, unfortunately, he had lost his at that point because he misquoted, you know, it's a mind is a terrible thing to waste, but I can appreciate, you know, the mind is a terrible thing to lose. All right. Both called him Lord. Okay. Any other similarities?
Well, I was going to say the geographic similarity that was mentioned that I see as a difference.
Okay.
Because Capernaum, I think of as their home base.
Uh-huh. As Jesus' home base?
As Jesus' home base.
It certainly is out of, in the second story, he certainly is out of his territory. But he's, yes.
Well,
have a little discussion.
Jerusalem is where God is, because that's where
right.
The temple is.
Precisely. For a Jew, that's
here
the
here we've got two stories that say, like saying nyet, nyet, nyet to all of you Southerners who mm-hmm. think this is, you really got it sewn up.
Those
yeah.
Bible belters.
Interestingly enough, when we were in John the other day and we talked about, he was afraid of the Jews.
Yeah.
I took a class where a professor said that was a terrible translation and that it should say the Judeans. Mm. And that what's really going on in the Gospels that we are missing completely is there was tremendous antipathy between the north and the south.
Yeah.
And so
sure.
So that those in the south who felt they had true religion were really irritated at things that were happening away from the center.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Well, thanks for that. We'll let you all have that conversation. Both did call him Lord. Any other similarities?
I want to question that too, Gladys. Isn't Lord Sir?
Yes.
I mean, it's not necessarily a religious title, is it?
Well, at this point, I think Kyrios really is a decidedly Christian title. Yeah, so Matthew's interpretation of this really is that both of them are calling Jesus by a religious title. Yeah. It's the same Lord that we would use in our Kyrie. Yeah. Which is odd, again, for Gentiles. I mean, that's another whole question, you know. How do these folks have faith? So, any other similarities?
This might already be covered in having someone come to ask him, but they both sought him out. We've had other
right.
stories to speak
yep.
about.
Exactly, with people
Jesus
seeking out Jesus.
Them.
Yeah. Right.
They both sought him out.
Yep.
Jesus also takes time to listen to what they're saying, to have a conversation.
Yeah, that's right. There really is a dialogue that happens in both of these before the healing. well, I'm not sure that Jesus...
I'm hesitant about the second right, one. He doesn't say a word.
Right. I want to say there is a dialogue that happens, but I'm not sure that in the second story Jesus listens. I mean, if anything, he seems to ignore the woman. And the disciples do too. You know, it's a bad rap for both of them. But there is a dialogue, though, in both of those before the healing takes place. What do I want to say? Anything else?
In both cases, the people that are approaching Jesus tell him that he doesn't have to do it his way, they can do it their way. The centurion says, no, you don't have to come to my house. And the woman says, yes, you can heal me.
Well, she's asking for healing for her daughter.
But it's that Jesus has this, okay, if I'm going to heal, I'll go to your house. And the centurion says, you don't have to.
Right.
Jesus has this mindset, I'm not going to heal your daughter. And she says, yes, you can.
And yes. All right.
So they get into changes mode.
Okay.
Modus operandi.
Okay.
7:45 class did not get that.
What was that?
7:45 class did not get
Here's
that.
Here's the other guy.
Thank you, Dave. A plus for the 9 o'clock.
You just didn't think it was relative.
All right. Anything else in terms of similarities?
Depends on what the score is here.
Some of you are familiar with Dan Erlander, and he wrote these great stories called The Stories of the Pointless People. You know? And it was just about this whole idea of how we keep score. It's great. anything else? Because now I want to get into the dissimilarities. How are they different? Okay? And I'm going to
self-deprecate.
What was that?
Yeah. Both requesters are self-deprecating.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting interpretation. The 7:45 group almost had an interpretation that the centurion is really schmoozing Jesus. Lord, you know, I know that you're a person with authority. I'm a person with authority. So that group really saw him more approaching Jesus. He said he's unworthy. And then goes on to talk about how worthy he is. You know, well, I have, you know, servants and tell them to do this, and I give the soldiers orders and they do this. But we'll take the centurion's perspective. Both, what did you call them?
Self-deprecating.
Right. I know how to spell it.
Meaning
they put themselves down. In their request. Okay, now, having written all of this up, you've committed it to memory. There will be a test today. I didn't tell you that. You can pick it up when you leave, and I will collect them then at lunch. All right, these are the similarities. Let's look at the differences now. I'll start them down here, and when I need to erase that, I will. How are these texts different?
We don't need the hymn.
Yeah, we don't need the hymn anymore.
Okay. Oh, that's good. You know, just a little sympathy. All right. That's a great idea. This is why we need community, you know, because we don't think of these things. Okay. Now we have the whole board to use. Tear it up. Okay.
He says yes to the centurion's request right away.
Yeah, he says yes to the centurion right away. I will come and cure.
Yeah.
Boy.
That's troublesome.
He says yes to the man and no to the woman.
Okay, hold on.
We've been waiting.
All right, he says yes to the centurion right away, and he really ignores her.
Ignores her.
Right?
That's sad.
Okay.
I'm sorry, are you saying something?
All right, now, did you say something about a man and a woman? Okay, he says yes to the man, really, and, yeah. And no to the woman. Okay. Yes, that's troublesome, isn't it?
Yeah, very.
That's why I picked this text. I thought we should end, you know, on a challenging note. Okay.
Yes to the slave and no to the child.
I don't think Jesus says no to the woman. It's
he ignores
her. He totally ignores her.
Right. Initially, he does say, he says nothing. He won't even react to her at all. Eventually, though, he does say, in effect, no.
Yes.
He says, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Yeah. So this is a provisional no, but I think this is not too far of a stretch. Other differences?
Oh, the slave child.
Slave child, right. He basically says yes to healing the slave or the servant. Right. And somebody else pointed out earlier that this very servant-child relationship makes the contrast all the more poignant, because here's a woman with her daughter. We're not quite sure, you know, I mean, the beneficent reading of the centurion's request is that he really does care for this paralyzed servant, you know, and doesn't want him to be healed so he can get back, you know, to work, but that he's compassionate. But even so, there's a qualitative difference between the relationship one has with one's servant and one's child. Okay, others. Nancy.
I see a difference with the centurion. He doesn't say, come help. He doesn't ask. He mm-hmm. just states a fact. He says, my servant is lying paralyzed at home in terrible distress. He doesn't say, come heal, come help. He just states the fact. With the question or the request implied, it's like saying, honey, supper's getting cold, but you haven't invited them to come to dinner.
I think that the implication is clear that, you know, healing is what's needed.
But then with the next one, the woman says, have mercy on me, and then she says, help me. It's much more putting herself out there where the centurion doesn't.
Yeah, there's a power differential for sure between the centurion and the kind of request he makes and the woman who really literally throws herself at Jesus' mercy. Yeah.
Well, the disciples were involved. Woman. I mean, they were present.
Right.
Maybe they had.
All right. Hold that thought for one second. She really pleads, right, Nancy? She pleads for help. Okay, you were saying?
Well, I wonder if the disciples had some influence over Jesus. I mean, they were present.
Yeah, this was
second, but not in the first. So
I'm going to assume that the disciples were there. But they have no speaking role in this interaction between the centurion. But the disciples even gang up on this woman, you know, and they say, you know, send her away.
Yeah.
So this is not one of the more complimentary pictures of Jesus and the disciples that we get. Others.
I want to suggest that we've said that there's dialogue in the book, but I think there's more difference than similarity.
Okay.
The Canaanite woman, there's truly a dialogue. She's got to make her case and keep on advancing the argument.
Oh.
And with the centurion, it's a teachable moment, but it's after the centurion has made his statement, and then Jesus turns and says to the disciples, did you hear what he said?
Yeah. Okay. Good. Others.
In the second one, there's a kind of a derogatory implication. It's not in the first one.
Oh.
It's with respect to the dogs.
Right.
Because in Israel, Jews did not have dogs. They were considered.
Yeah, and this whole business of, you know, the dogs, this has been interesting to see some of the shifting in terms of biblical scholarship around interpretation of this text. Because I'd say, I mean, certainly for the 19th and earlier parts of the 20th century, almost all of the biblical scholars were male. And so their interpretation of this, you know, was that Jesus was testing her faith, and, you know, he really, this was not an offensive thing at all. It wasn't derogatory. You know, it's like, oh, she's just a little puppy, and how sweet, you know, little puppies. That emphasis really has begun to shift in terms of how feminist, womanist, and other, you know, more liberated interpreters of scripture are reading this text. Today, I think many people would say, we can't read this, you know, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs as anything other than offensive. Yes?
Got one other contrast. In the story about the centurion, in verse 12, it says, while the heirs of the kingdom will be thrown into outer darkness where there will be weeping, gnashing of teeth. Mm-hmm. Not quite sure who the heirs of the kingdom are, but you contrast that with Jesus saying in the story of the Canaanite, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Yeah, if you
and were... I'm just, you know, the heirs of the kingdom might be the Israelites.
Well, certainly from Matthew's perspective, the Jesus that we see up until the time of the crucifixion and resurrection is a Jesus who understands himself to be sent for the Jews. In Matthew chapter 10, verses 5 and 6, where he has called the disciples to him and he sends them out and he says, go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Go to no Samaritan town. So these two texts are actually aberrations in Matthew's gospel, where Jesus actually has some kind of encounter with Gentiles, because Matthew's Jesus is a Jesus who understands himself to be for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Then it's not until we get to Matthew 28, the Great Commission, where Jesus, the post-resurrection Jesus, now says, go make disciples of all nations. Okay. Yes.
I think in the case of the centurion, it's the only place I know of where Jesus is surprised.
Is surprised?
Yeah. Surprised, astonished by the centurion's faith.
And well, similarly, I think with the woman. I mean, there it has that kind of connotation when he says, woman, great is your faith. You know, those two remarks are... they're not identical in terms of the comments, but those endings really are very similar. So I'd see that more as a similarity between the two texts rather than a difference. We talked about commending
Bibles at their feet.
Yeah. Other different, yes?
Well, the woman asks for mercy on herself to heal the daughter, and the centurion is kind of commenting that he has a paralyzed servant and if Jesus would care to do something about it, it would be nice.
And she eventually kneels in front of him.
She is really willing to go to whatever depth she needs to on behalf of her child. And you know, what mother or father is not going to do that if that's going to make it right for their kid?
No? So if the Canaanite woman, instead of coming to Jesus, never mind.
Is that your final answer?
For now.
Any other differences that you see? Let's think of the difference in terms of their, just the tone of the conversation. If you can picture the conversation between Jesus and the centurion, how would you hear that? Two equals kind of conversing with each other, right? Now picture the conversation. Right, that's book signing. You'll have half an hour to get your book signed, so anybody that leaves this Bible study is in trouble. I'm kidding. If you can picture or hear the conversation between Jesus and the woman, not the conversation, but the scene, what is this like?
Well,
twice, what does it say? She what?
She's a pest.
She is a pest. What is she doing?
Shouting.
She is shouting here, trying to get Jesus' attention and that of the woman. Yes? I mean, of the disciples. Now, here's the question for some conversation. Why is it that those who are on the fringes, those who are on the outside, need to shout in order to get the attention of the folks on the inside? What is that about?
Power.
Yes, Jeff.
I've been seeing both of these stories, and watching Jesus walk into the city square in Capernaum, and this centurion in his guard walks up to him, and I'm sure the crowd parts when a centurion walks through. Mm. And he walks up to Jesus and says, Lord, my servant, back home.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, what's Jesus going to do? Ignore him. Whereas they're out
right
away to the district of Tyre and Sidon. It doesn't say that they're in a city. They could be out sort of on the road somewhere. Mm-hmm. And this woman comes chasing after him. Yo, Jesus! Yo!
That's very interesting. In the earlier group, we talked about how radical a thing it was that Jesus would heal the servant of the opposition, as it were. Your take is really different. You know, how could Jesus not do that, given the fact that he's the opposition? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying just the whole feel of what's going on. The setting is different.
Right.
The power of the person approaching Jesus is so different to begin with. Jesus can't ignore the guy. Mm. What he could say to the centurion is, well, that's really sad. I feel your pain.
I was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
Yeah, sorry.
But he didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a caste system, and there's...
Oh, certainly. I mean, women were, you know, at the bottom of the rung. There was no question about that. This woman had no power. She had no power. Yes?
Getting back to the question...
Of the shouting?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because those who have developed the system where they're on top of the others want to perpetuate it and think everything's fine. And it's not until the dam breaks, be it through civil disobedience or revolution or whatever might be the context, that you'll do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a poignant example related to me some years ago. A fellow was talking about gays and lesbians in the church, and he's a very articulate speaker, and people were anxious to hear him talk that night, and he said, well, meet me at like this room at 6 o'clock or something. So when the people got over here, the doors were taped shut.
Mm.
And they had to go through this, well, wait out there, we'll get to you, just hold on.
Mm.
And it was an example of how they're not brought into the center,
yeah,
kept out there. And I think we can see that in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. I mean, I was telling the earlier group, I remember when I was a kid and the civil rights movement was going on, I can still remember, you know, hearing people, particularly white people, you know, saying, why don't those black people stop? Why aren't they happy? You know, because change is happening. You know, why do they have to keep having these demonstrations and sit-ins and civil disobedience, you know, and the marches and all that stuff? Change is happening. And that was really troubling to folks, that those who are on the outside seem to have to do that in order to get the attention to shift to the injustice. Yes, here, and then I want to make sure that we let everybody in.
Mm-hmm.
Emma's mom. I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
heard a comment, our church walked in the game Pride Parade in Minneapolis, and heard a comment from somebody else, why do they have to be so
loud?
Yeah, it was something, it wasn't loud, it was similar, like so out there, so, yeah, you know, right, this, so this. And I was thinking in my head, you know, well, they need to because you're not listening.
Right.
You
know, it's like, exactly.
You know, they've got to get your attention. And until they do, you know, this is, you know, like.
Remember this the next time the child is coming up, Mommy, Mommy, Mommy. Not quite the same, but it has a similar feel. So I'm.
Well, isn't she really taking a chance here in that being of a lower caste as she was, and then insisting is really, taking a chance, but even more than that, she's really setting herself up for something else by being so vocal.
Well, she's certainly taking a big risk.
Yeah.
And even with the risk, you know, until the third plea, she's ignored.
Mm-hmm.
She's ignored.
And
that is all the more painful. I mean, imagine those who really are marginalized in our society, whether they're gay and lesbian, folks with AIDS, people of color, folks, just take our Native American brothers and sisters. I mean, they are on the very edge of American society, literally and figuratively. You know, it's no accident, for instance, that in urban areas, housing projects where poor people, whether they're white people or black people, live, are on the margins of the city. That's not accidental. Same with reservations. It's like out of sight, out of mind. And so, you know, this notion then of not only being pushed to the margin, but ignored on top of it is all the more painful. Yeah. Did I see a hand somewhere else? Okay. Here and then Dave.
Well, going back to your question again, there's so many institutions then that will preserve the power structure. And I'm thinking of, and this will only take a moment.
Yes.
Sports Illustrated, a nice magazine, and they talk about, okay, we got Jackie Robinson here, right, and Willie Mays, and so we're starting to hold them up as examples. In a recent edition, there was a long article on four athletes, who three of whom were significantly harmed, shot multiple times by police, for driving while black. And I thought, now we're transferring it, which putting it into a different sources of information, and we're looking at it in all sorts of contexts, seeing four athletes gunned down by New Jersey State Troopers driving while black.
And, oh, pick and, my state. Yeah. Well, we've got a bad rap, and it's true.
Yeah, and we would not, like 60 years ago, 30 years ago, I was hearing too, what are the blacks talking about? Everything's good. Well, it is so deep and perverse,
exactly,
that we're still bringing up stuff.
Yeah, well, this is precisely, I mean, so many of the injustices in our society and world are systemic injustices, that it's not going to be until we understand how the system works and how the system, by its very nature, is intent on keeping the status quo. That's why it's so important for us in the church to get at the root, whether it's homophobia, racism, sexism, class elitism, one of the fringes that Michael has brought our attention to this whole week is how fringe those who have no voice, i.e. our animal companions and other species are. You know, and if people don't speak for them, who's going to do the shouting for them? Dave?
I was thinking back to Jeff's comment about the crowd partying for the centurion. And I suppose just another take on the same discussion we're having, but in the male world, or at least the white male world, or at least the white male world today, you recognize office. You don't recognize people, you recognize office. So, you know, Jeff's comment, what's Jesus going to do? Well, he's right. I mean, it's a violation of the male code. When an office meets an office, you either recognize it or you declare war. And so, I don't know that Jesus is me.
Is that in the genes, Dave?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's current or if it's old, but I mean,
it's in the slacks.
For Jesus to ignore the centurion when he ignored the woman,
yeah,
would be a whole different dynamic. Because he's dealing with an office and a woman has an office. So
even given the cultural differences.
I think so. I mean, okay. You go to war movies, you know, and after the blowing up of Hiroshima, you've got the American general and the Japanese general shaking hands. Good war. You know, you lost some guys, you lost some guys. You did a good job, you know. And there's this mutual respect thing going on for the office, you know. And I just offer that as a male perspective on this. There's a... Lawyers do the same thing, you know. You fight tooth and nail, and then they go out for beer afterwards. And because you deal out of the office is the only word. You deal out of a position, not a personal involvement. Per se.
Okay, but then so, but it really is then the power dynamic at work. Yeah. Okay.
Because it's a pure, in that sense, it's a purity system. If you don't have an office, you can't play.
Right.
But what was Jesus' office?
Rabbi. I mean, by the centurion, by coming to him and being deferential.
Is recognizing, that's right, that Jesus certainly has some status.
And that's the conversation. Okay. You're a person of office, I'm a person of office. Boom, 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 boom. It's a very male discussion.
Yeah.
And to my ears.
Uh-huh. Okay, there was somebody over here that, okay, Michael, then Chris. Okay.
I want to focus a little bit on the dynamic that's going on between Jesus and the disciples in this.
Okay.
As we talk, I mean, the sense that, yes, this woman is ignored by everyone, there's silence, but one of the interesting things is that Jesus doesn't seem to be bothered by that, in that he just keeps on walking, and it's the disciples that come forward and kind of give this, you know, Jesus, aren't you going to do something? This woman is bothering. Mm-hmm. You know? And so it's, and then again, the conversation that's there, what Jesus says, we really have no as to whether this is addressed to the disciples or what. It doesn't seem like the woman is addressed at all until that last sentence, when it becomes very clear in the text, you know, Jesus says to her, daughter, and so, I mean, it's not quite clear. There's a wonderful ambiguity there in terms of who is Jesus talking to in all of this. Is it for the disciples? And again, the sense of the context of this chapter begins with the whole notion of defilement. Yep. And so perhaps, again, the disciples' request there is, you know, Jesus, get rid of her, you know, she's spoiling, she's defiling the group. And so there's that whole issue there. What are the disciples going to do about it? Yeah. Well, they just want to pass it off on Jesus.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, I don't hear this as quite as ambiguous. I don't hear the disciples so much saying, what are you going to do about this, Jesus? But the whole purity issue is probably where they are. You know, get rid of her. I mean, this is not, I really don't think the disciples are advocating for Jesus to pay attention to her as much as it is, you know, get rid of her. We don't need this defilement, as it were. And Jesus seems to be speaking to the disciples when he says, I was only sent to the, you know, lost sheep of the house of Israel. You're right, Michael. It's not until the very end where Jesus actually addresses this woman.
Verse 26, I think, is addressed to her. She says, Lord, help me. He answered.
There's not fair to
hold on. Let me...
There.
Right. When he says it's not fair, but when in verse 23, he did not answer her at all, and his disciples came and urged him, saying, send her away, and he answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.
So the
disciple, you know, send her away, I'm only here for Jewish folks. I think Jesus is still ignoring the woman. Yeah. Chris, sorry.
What eats me up when I read this is the statement they make before they get acknowledged for their great faith, because even though they both are stating their faith in their right for healing, his is, I'm in power, I relate to you, and hers is, yeah, but even the dogs get crumbs.
Yeah.
And so it's not, I mean, there's no turning of power, there's no upside down. There's,
right.
You're acknowledging your lower position, you're acknowledging your higher position, how great is your faith.
Yeah, I mean, this woman is incredibly humble. incredibly humble, and incredibly bright. Mm-hmm. You know, at each step, she seems to be respectful of Jesus, Lord, Son of David, you know, please help me. And even to the point where Jesus uses this crude and somewhat offensive analogy of, well, it's not right to take the children's bread and give it to the dogs. She's right there with him, you know. She doesn't try to argue against that analogy. Instead, she uses his analogy to really expand his understanding and says, yes, but even, you know, even the dogs get to eat the crumbs under the table. I mean, that's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome when you think that she could talk about a lawyer, you know, that she could use his own argument to influence him to change his mind. Nancy?
So was she stretching Jesus's vision?
Well, see, this is, I think, this is part of the debate that goes on about this particular text in terms of interpretation. You know, some would see this as yes, indeed, she really is helping expand Jesus' understanding of what his mission is all about. And there are certainly some biblical scholars today, self included, who would come down in that perspective, that she really is pushing Jesus to open up, you know, his understanding of what his mission is all about. Others would see that as absolutely anathema to what you know, Jesus is all about. I mean, if in fact Jesus is God, then how is God going to be influenced? Well, I mean, it's been fascinating for us to take the classes with Dan and Karen, because I mean, part of what I've heard, you know, through their teaching us about Judaism is that absolutely, you know, we're partners with God, and so this whole sense that we can influence God is very much at work. So I would certainly be on the side that says this woman and Rachel Conrad Wahlberg, I don't know, you know, 20-some years ago wrote a book called Jesus According to Women, where she talks about this woman and describes her as the uppity woman. And, you know, how great it is that this uppity woman literally, well, she doesn't literally get into Jesus' face because she's so humble that she's doing this from a point of humility. But even with that, she is stating her case to the end. Beth?
There's many other stories where Jesus is respectful and compassionate and inclusive towards women.
Yeah.
And even earlier in Matthew, I think, is the story about the woman with the hemorrhage who comes up. And
that's in Luke, actually.
It's also in Matthew.
Okay.
And so it's earlier than this. And whether the chronology of the way these stories have been recorded for us are truly chronological or not, I want to see this as more of her being on the outside because she's not from Israel.
She's not from Israel. She's a woman, and she has this sick daughter. So, you know, she's got three strikes in terms of what makes the defilement so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. If the Jews are the chosen people, not because they're God's favorite, but because they were chosen to bring this message,
the light
of God to the world, can we see this as Jesus is sent to come to Israel first because they already know God? There's a better chance for them to understand that he's the Son of God. And then all of them can become disciples to the rest of the nation.
Well, I think that would probably be how Matthew would interpret this, you know, because there's a movement, again, from, you know, chapter 10, where the disciples are called lost sheep of Israel, this one, lost sheep of Israel, and then these two little, like, previews of the mission to the Gentiles.
Well, and a third one.
With the centurion and with this woman. What, Jeff?
There's a third preview.
Okay.
And the Magi show up.
Yeah, early on. You know, early on we have the Magi at Jesus' birth. So these are all these wonderful little, you know, the more you read Scripture, again, trying to do it from the particular perspective of that writer, the more you get to see these little, you know, wonderful glimpses of what was this writer all about. To have those wise men at Jesus' birth already, you know, is a sign that this one is not just going to be, you know, the savior of his people, but the whole world. Till we get to 28. Okay, Kathy, and then...
Wayne.
Wayne? Okay.
Following up on the comments that this is taking a risk, I guess I would ask, what is the risk? I mean, to me, it seems like she really didn't have any choice. Mm. I mean, being at the bottom, what was the risk?
Well, it's a good question. I guess, I mean, the risk is the humiliation, you know, that she's received. But, you know, her own humiliation is obviously not nearly as important as her daughter's healing. Wayne?
When we used to discipline one of our daughters and she didn't like it, she would say, "Stop shouting at me." You know, when we hadn't even raised our voice at all.
Yeah.
The disciples in this case seem to be having that kind of petulant reaction. To, as I read the text, she asked once, and he says, they say to him, "She keeps shouting at us." It's almost as if they're trying to keep Jesus on target. "Don't you mess with these Gentiles now." And then he answers, "That's right, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel."
I take it a little bit different.
Okay.
I kind of think that the disciples watch Jesus to see his reaction, and he doesn't say anything. Shoot, if he doesn't do anything about this woman, they're not going to be able to heal her. If he's not going to heal her, she's going to be tagging after him all day long. So if you're not going to heal her,
get her away.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
For me, this really points out, and it's a good lesson for me, is that she's persistent.
Yep.
So many times, you know, I pray and I think, you know, Jesus isn't hearing me, and he says, "Be persistent in your prayer." And
absolutely. And I do think that that's one of the emphases of this text, is that persistence pays off. It definitely does pay off. And again, as we think about our own struggles for justice, persistence pays off. You know, sometimes when you get defeated, whether it's the church program, you know, that doesn't go through trying to do ministry with homeless folks, or the anti-racism program that nobody understood, kind of keeping at it is really important. And this woman, at least according to this text, didn't have a community that was supporting her. So imagine the courage. You know, I mean, I think about... like Harriet Tubman, you know, what an incredible woman she must have been. Clearly on the fringe, slave, escapes, and then makes over, you know, 120 trips back into danger for the sake of the brothers and sisters. You know, talk about persistence. Where do people get that kind of courage, you know? The ability to humble themselves for the sake of the greater healing, you know? That's pretty awesome. Yes, Michael.
I think there's also a wonderful irony and kind of tongue-in-cheek thing going on here, too, when Jesus says, I've come only for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And part of that irony is, if that's the case, then what is he doing trotting around up in Tyre and Sidon? You know, he's kind of lost, right? I mean, it's like saying, well, I've come only for the lost sheep of...
He is one of the lost sheep.
Well,
he is one of the lost sheep. That's why he's up there.
He's one of the lost sheep. Is he already stretching the notion of what it is to be part of the house of Israel because of his pronouncement to this woman as well, when he calls her daughter, just like you had earlier in your...
Does he call her daughter?
No.
Woman.
It's her, no, her daughter gets healed, but it's her, I think that the commentaries that I read on this, Michael, said that, you know, Jesus has now had this major confrontation with the Pharisees, and so there's a sense in which he needs to get away, and that's why he goes to this fringe territory, but doesn't actually go into Gentile territory, but he's right on the edge.
No, I think that's almost overly historicizing the sense of the narrative.
To say that Jesus is really trying to escape, that's one reading of this. Interesting, you know, that, I mean, Jeff's perspective that, you know, maybe Jesus is one of the lost sheep too. I think it is pretty clear that at least the Jesus pictured in this text is one who has definitely undergone some kind of change within this conversation. And that in and of itself is a model for us, you know, that somebody said this the other day, when we think that we know it, not necessarily all, but, you know, we've got the way, we've got the truth, and we know what the life is all about. You know, to see ourselves like Jesus, open to being transformed by somebody on the margins. Colleen told the story the other day about, you know, the woman from the soup kitchen who went, you know, into the city and kept wanting to give this poor guy a hot dog. And the guy finally says to her, "Lady, I can eat anywhere. What I need is somebody to listen to me." You know, to see ourselves as people who are willing to be transformed by those who are on the margins is really powerful for us in the church. Any final comments before we need to wrap it up?
There's so many occasions where Jesus, the author describes Jesus knew what was in the man's heart, and knew what was in her heart. And it's not specifically said here. I want to read this. He's giving her the chance to help him teach everybody else. He knows what she's going to say. Yeah. He knows what she needs. Yeah. That if he gives her the right line, she's going to give the teachable moment to the disciples. And so maybe that takes away from her ability to affect him so much as...
Yeah, I don't see Matthew's Jesus in that way. I think John's Jesus, for sure, you know, is that Jesus who gets portrayed as knowing what's in everybody's heart. The Jesus of Matthew is one, I think, who is going through, you know, a process of self-discovery of what does it mean, you know, to be the person that I am. And so I see this, I do see this. I mean, you're open to your own interpretation, but I see this as a teachable moment for Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just also, as we've been discussing, the thought came to me that maybe Jesus is also kind of teaching us or the disciples a lesson.
Mm.
Maybe when the woman comes up and says, you know, blah, 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 and they say, you know, Jesus, she's shouting at us, and he makes the comments, and they go, I kind of see the disciples going, see? She's not supposed to be in.
Mm.
Kind of like the church has done for in its history.
Right.
The smugness of, see, you're right, Jesus says, get her out of here. And then she keeps up, and finally Jesus turns around and says, you know, how great is your faith? And so I wonder if it was a little surprising for the disciples, too, is to say, see, we knew what was going on, but then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, well, here we go again. He's doing, you know, he's just doing this.
Yeah. No, I think that's a very useful insight, especially for us in the church. You know, we have those uppity people that we want to send away, ignore, not deal with, and yet they're not going to go away. As long as there's injustice, the folks are going to be there crying for our attention.
I keep thinking of the Canaanite woman, and she's seeing this new revelation happening that Jesus is starting, and she's saying, don't forget about us, the dogs, or whatever you want to refer to her. And so I keep thinking about Sojourner Truth during the women's suffrage movement, when she was involved in the movement, and she's a black slave, and she's saying, well, ain't I a woman?
Mm-hmm.
So because black women were being ignored in this women's movement.
Yeah.
So then you think about Audre Lorde in the civil rights movement. They're moving for black privilege, and she's saying, well, don't forget about us lesbians.
Right.
So,
sure.
So within every movement, you have to look to the fringes to say, well, who are we ignoring? And
absolutely. And that's
needed to be
started. That's right. And that was Michael's comment earlier, that in terms of various liberation movements, those who are on the fringes, let's not forget about our sister, brother species who don't have a voice unless we speak for them too. And somehow then we have to figure out a way to not have all of those who are on the outside kind of fighting with each other and missing the power in the center. So broad-based coalitions of support within congregations, beyond congregations, that are going to advance the healing of all creation is what we need. Listen, thank you for a fabulous week of engaging the Word together. And wherever you go, may God go with you. Thanks a lot.
Awesome.